This presentation is brought to you by iAwaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
Now we're in chapter 6, verse 11, if I remember correctly. That will start with verse 13. So the first half of chapter 6, which we did last week, Eov rejects Eliphaz's suggestion, where Eliphaz says that the suffering he's undergoing is some kind of punishment, it's some kind of a result of bad deeds that he's done, and Eov says he's not willing to accept that, primarily because there's no proportion. Whatever bad deeds he might have done would have been so small compared to the enormity of the suffering that he's being subjected to that it just doesn't make sense at all. And he ends up saying the one thing he is sure of is ki lo kichadati imrei kodesh. He can't think of any case that he's ever done anything wrong against the Ribbono Shel Olam. And in the second half of chapter 6 he launches into an attack against Eliphaz. And he says, let's start at verse 13, Yud Gimel. Ha'im ein ezrosi vi v'sushiyo nidcho mimeni. Is there no help within myself? And is salvation totally removed from me? Can I be that bad, in other words? As far as I'm concerned, I'm a tzaddik. As far as I'm concerned, I'm not aware of anything I've done wrong. And Eov doesn't say this with any degree of arrogance or any degree of exaggeration. After careful analysis of his life and an understanding of his life and I suppose if we take the view that Eov was written by Moshe Rabbeinu, if we take that view and the fact that although Moshe had, we like to look at Moshe's life as a very fulfilling one, but it was a very rough one. He went through enormous hardship throughout his life. He was raised without his parents. He was raised artificially in Pharaoh's palace, which was no pleasure for him. He then had to flee as a young man, lands up in Midian, away from his people, away from his family, has to marry a girl from Midian. Just look at Moshe's life. Lives there until the burning bush episode, by which time he's already a man of 80. So until he's 80, he's done nothing with his life. Yes, he's become a tzaddik, but he hasn't really achieved, he hasn't set up anything in terms of normal things. Okay, he's not a slave, at least he's saved that. He's, the rest of his community are in Mitzrayim, suffering even worse. So at least that, Moshe Rabbeinu has been saved. But if you look at it in our terms, until he's 80, which is well beyond retirement age, all he's been is a shepherd. He's been a shepherd. He's lived a lone life outside of his community, outside of his nation, exiled, a fugitive, in fear of his life, all the time that Paro might, there's a death sentence hanging over him. That's the kind of life he had until he was 80. And when he was 80, he achieved international prominence too, but he didn't want it at that stage. All he wanted at that stage was a quiet old age. And he lands up with prominence, with international prominence, leading Bnei Yisrael, which was a terribly thankless task. It's something he didn't want in the first place. He offered to give it up several times on the way. It wasn't something that gave him any kind of pleasure or joy at all. So there were a few highlights in his life. He goes to Har Sinai, he gets the Torah, later on the Mishkan gets built. There are a few highlights in his life. But generally he's an old man taking on an enormous responsibility at a time that he doesn't want it, and living a life where he's constantly criticized. And finally the one thing he wants in his life, the one chance he's going to have to settle down quietly and live a normal sort of life among his people without the responsibilities of all that leadership, to be able to retire for the end of his life in Eretz Yisrael. No, says the Rebbe Yisrael. You got angry once with the Bnei Yisrael. Once you got angry, you can't go to Eretz Yisrael. So the only true ambition that he had for himself, the only true ambition that he had for himself in his entire life, he might have had two ambitions for himself, that his children should succeed him and that he should live in Eretz Yisrael. He was denied both of them. So it's actually the Chazal that say that Iyuv was written by Moshe makes a lot of sense. And that although he's describing here terrible physical suffering, he's using that physical suffering as an image for the way he felt. That Moshe would rather have had this kind of physical suffering and being able to live the kind of life he wanted to than to have the physical comfort and live the way he did live. So it's a very interesting angle of Moshe's self-perception and of his own anguish and his own searching. And then we understand why he's so insistent all the time that he's a tzaddik. He says, what have I, Moshe Rabbeinu, done to deserve this? What have I done? I believe I'm enough of a tzaddik to say I don't deserve this. At least that. So if we take that view, it casts beautiful light both on the book of Iyuv and on the life of Moshe Rabbeinu. And one then understands this where he says, the one thing I know is ki lo yichadati imrei kodesh. I've never denied a word of the Ribbono Shel Olam. That much. And if you say that I've done wrong, it doesn't make any sense that I should be punished so enormously for having done what kind of wrong could I have done after all. So now he launches into an attack against Eliphaz and he says, Hayim ein ezrosi vi v'sushio nidcho mimeni. Do I not have the capacity for self-help? Is there no ability to help myself? Why should I be dependent on you, Eliphaz? V'sushio nidcho mimeni. And why should the path of my own salvation be taken away from me? Lamos mireyehu chosed. And why should it be given to one who deprives his friend of kindness? The yiras shadai yazoiv. One who deprives his friend of kindness and thereby forsakes the fear of the Ribbono Shel Olam. You think you're such a tzaddik, Eliphaz? You think you're so worthy, and I'm the wicked man? But look what you've just done, Eliphaz. You've taken a man who's suffering, and you've accused him of wrongs that you can't even substantiate. You've made him feel even worse. What kind of a tzaddik do you think you are? It's all very well saying you're frum. You can't be frum if that's how you're treating other people. If that's how you're treating human beings, you can't be a righteous man. And if you're not a righteous man, how come, I wonder, says Eve, that God chose to speak to you and not to me? Maybe I'm not perfect, but I'm better than you. That's what he says. I don't treat people the way you've just treated me. And if God had a message for me, why didn't he send that message to me directly? Why did he come to you with it? And again, if Eve is Moshe, if this Sefer was written by Moshe, then we understand also how he says, why doesn't God tell me direct? I have access to Hashem. Hashem does speak to me. Why this particular message hasn't he sent to me? Why did he tell you all this? So that you've got to come and tell me in a distorted sort of fashion, which makes me feel much worse than I am. What's it all about? And then he goes on to give the image of the way he feels about his friends. And he says, Achai bogdu kemo nochal. My brothers, in other words, you, my friends, have been treacherous like a river. Ka'afik nachalim ya'aviru, like the waterways of rivers and streams that pass. Ha'kodrim minei korach, they get blackened with ice. Olemo yis'alim sholeg. Upon which snow disappears. Be'es yizorvu nitzmosu. At times when they begin to grow warm, when the summer comes, they disappear. When it gets hot, they melt out of their places. So you never know where you stand with these rivers. Comes the winter and they get ice and strong, people walk on them, people trust them. They walk on them, they stand on them, the children play on them. All of a sudden it gets a little warm, gone, they're no longer there to support the people who are walking on them. The cracks start coming, they start melting, they no longer support people, you can't trust them. Yilofsu orchis darkom yalu batuyu v'yovedu. When the travelers come, they rely on the rivers in order to drink from them. And when they look for them, there's nothing there and they die. Water disappears. There's supposed to be water there. There isn't water there. You can never trust. You never know. Hibitu orchis temo. The travelers look towards temo. Halichu savo. They trust and hope for the waterways of Shavo. They were let down, they were disappointed having trusted. They came here and they were put to shame. For now you are just like that, is the one way of translating it. You, my friends, are just like the river. And the other way of translating it is, ki ato, for now at one point, he yisem lo, you are for him, you are for your friend. When you came here to comfort me, you sat quietly and you allowed me to speak. And then tiru chasas vatiro. And then you saw trembling. You saw the debate started, the discussion started, severe issues were raised. Batiro, and you got scared to stand up for your friends. Who did you choose to stand up for? For God. I'm challenging God, says Eev. And you were my friends, I expected you to support me. And you're too scared to get involved in the argument. I'm taking on God, and you're not going to pick a fight with God, so you side with God, and God is my support. That image is very important because he's talking about that, what he expected from them. He's taking on the Ribono Shel Olam, and he's not taking on the Ribono Shel Olam in a way of disbelief, in a way in a heretic sort of way, although his friends are accusing him of that and saying, look, you're really shouting against the Ribono Shel Olam. But as we'll see, as the Sefer unfolds itself, he's searching, he's trying to understand, he's not prepared to just accept. That's the essence of Eev. He's not prepared to accept dogma, he's not prepared to accept slogans, he's not just because that's what they say, because he's not prepared to do that. He needs to understand, he needs to integrate, and in order to get to that point, you need to challenge. And that's one of the things that nowadays we're becoming afraid to do, and it's wrong. There are two kinds of challenging. There's a challenging which is a rebellion. That we're not permitted to do. We're not permitted to rebel against the Ribono Shel Olam. Through all this, Eve doesn't stop keeping the mitzvahs. Through all this, Eve doesn't start eating treif. He doesn't stop keeping Shabbos. It's not rebellion. He'll carry on. That's not the problem. But carrying on doing doesn't necessarily mean blind acceptance. There is a difference, and we often get that difference confused. And we think that if we question, we are rebelling. It's not so. We're rebelling if we discard. But as long as we're practicing, we're not rebelling. And if we're practicing, we're allowed to be free in our thinking. That's the beauty of the phrase that we uttered when we were at Har Sinai. Naseh v'nishma. We will do. That's the first one. Don't worry, Ribono Shel Olam. One thing we guarantee, absolutely, one thing we undertake. Naseh, the halacha we will keep. Whether we understand it or we don't understand it, whether we like it or we don't like it, that we're committing ourselves to. Naseh. It's that commitment which allows us the freedom to search. It's that commitment which allows us the freedom to question. If we didn't have that commitment, we would have no right to question. Why not? Because our questioning would then be rebellion. There's no questioning which is rebellion is immoral questioning. Questioning which is searching is moral questioning. And if one isn't committed to doing and one questions, there's no way the questioning can be honest. Because a person who questions when he isn't committed is using the questioning process to justify his non-committal. It's inevitable. If a person isn't keeping the mitzvahs, and he starts, I'm questioning, I'm an honest person, and I won't keep the mitzvahs unless I understand it. He's not trying to understand it. He's trying to satisfy himself that he can't understand it, and therefore he's justified in not keeping it. That's the whole process. It's not an intellectually honest process. If a child is disobeying a father, and questions the father, why do you want me to do this? He doesn't want to hear the answer why. He's not trying to find out the answer why. He's trying to disprove and to question in a way which relieves him of the responsibility. But a child that says, Father, I'll do it. There's no question I'll do it. I'll do it because you're my father. I don't understand why, and I don't agree with it, but I'll do it. Now that I've told you I'll do it, please sit down with me and explain to me. And I want you to explain to me properly. I won't let you off the hook. I want to understand why you want me to do this. It's a different kind of discussion. Immediately the defenses are down, the father's willing to discuss, he's willing to open up. And the child can question as much as he wants, and the father will take pleasure in that questioning. The child says, whatever it is, I want to go to a party on Saturday night. The father says, no, you will not go. The child says, why not? Immediately the father's reaction is, because I said no. What kind of an intellectual discussion is that? Why not? Because I said no. Why? And why did you say no? Because I'm your father. And why do I have to listen to you? Because you're my father. What kind of, it's childish. But that's the way the discussion goes, because the child doesn't want to know the reasons, and the father doesn't want to discuss the reasons. But if the child says, I really want to go to that party tonight, but I'm not going to go. You said no, and that's it, finished. That's the end of the story. We're not going to discuss anymore whether I'm going or not. I'm not going. But now you sit down with me until I'm satisfied. I want to know the reasons why. How does the father react? Different story. Fine, son, sit down, let's talk. I'll explain to you why not. And if the child just accepts it, he says, why not? Because I'm your father. And if the child says, oh, is that why? I understand. Good. Okay. What does the father feel? What is Shlemiel of the son? That's what he feels. Does he accept such nonsense? That doesn't give the father any pleasure. If the child says, father says, because I'm your father, the child says, one second. You might be my father, but I'm not a baby. And don't talk to me that way. That's not an intelligent answer. With due respect, father, that's not an intelligent answer. I need to understand the reasoning. Why it is? What is the reason that you don't want me to go? Why, as my father, don't you want me to go? And then the father discusses why not, because of the influences that are there, and whatever his reasons are. And the child says, but I won't be influenced. And the child and the father gives a whole discussion to him as what influence is and how it works and why it works. And it's all on the basis of Maaseh. I'm not questioning whether I'll do it or I won't do it. I'm not going. That's not the discussion. It's purely a matter of understanding now. And we've got to be very careful in our discussions with people in general on all matters to clarify for ourselves and the person that we're talking to what kind of discussion are we having. Has there been a Maaseh? Has our authority been accepted and we're discussing reasons? Or is the whole issue being discussed? Because they're two different types of debate, and one treats them in a completely different way. And that's the beauty of Eif, and that's the beauty of our relationship with the Ribbono Shel Olam. We are permitted to ask why. We are permitted to take any halacha in the Torah, any law in the Torah, any verse in the Torah, any chazal, and analyze it, and analyze it, and analyze it. Not just until we understand what it says, but until we understand why it says it. And we might never fully understand why it says it. We don't have the intellect and the capacity to understand the totality of God's reasoning. But we have the capacity to understand some of it. And we're entitled and obligated to question and question and question until we understand. And the reason we're entitled to do that and obligated to do that is because we've already said nicer. We've already said revenge, and we're not questioning whether we'll do it or not. Of course we'll do it. That's not the issue. But we also, the second part of that deal, after Maaseh came Nishma. And Nishma doesn't just mean we will hear. Obviously we've heard already, otherwise we wouldn't know what to do. So when we say Maaseh, that means we've heard and we will do. So what does the Nishma mean? Nishma means we will hear with a capital H. We'll really hear, we'll integrate, we'll understand. It will become part of us. That's what Nishma means. That's the kind of hearing process that Nishma means. And so Naaseh, yes, there was the element of Naaseh. But the second part of that sentence was Mishra. We undertook, together within our undertaking to comply with the Torah, we undertook to question and question and question until we understood. And that's why Eev gets upset with his friends. He says, you came along, poor Eev. So you came along to comfort poor Eev. And as long as I was poor Eev, you felt comfortable too. You were on the upper hand, you were fine, and you've come to comfort this poor man who's lost his family and suffered terrible illness and all sorts of suffering, and you've come to comfort him. Very nice. I thought I had friends. And you sat there quietly for 7 days. And so I thought that I could start talking. I thought you really sympathized and empathized with me, and that you would talk me through my searching. That you would come with me in the search of understanding the meaning of suffering. What do? I start taking God on, and you don't treat me intellectually. You don't listen to what I'm saying and treat it intellectually. You start with religious slogans. And you said, it's all the shit, all from the Rishon, because you must have done something wrong. That's it. The Rishon doesn't punish without no suffering without sin. The Rishon doesn't punish unless you've done something wrong. So sorry, Eve, you must have done something wrong. That's so superficial, says Eve. If we accept that, we're just not going to get anywhere to any major understanding. And Eve is almost saying to them, let us assume I haven't done wrong. Maybe at the end of our discussion, after days and days of discussion, maybe we'll have to throw that axiom out. Maybe we'll have to find that I have done something wrong. But let's not start there, because if we start there, we'll never really understand the meaning of suffering. Let us search hard to see, is it possible that there could be such suffering even if I haven't done wrong? Let's start that way. Maybe it is possible. Maybe there's a reason for it. I've suggested a reason. An outrageous reason, but it's the only one I can think of. And that is that God has handed over part of the running of the world to a program which He doesn't interfere with. And it gets the good with the bad. And there's nothing you can do about it. That's the way the world operates. Maybe that's what I'm throwing out as an opening idea. And I'm hoping that you can grab that idea and we can discuss that idea. And instead you throw a slogan at me. That's what Eve gets upset about. And we're going to see that going on right through the Sefer with his friends. That they keep on treating him by quotations from Chazal. And even if they didn't have Chazal in those days in the form that we have it today, it's the equivalent of quotations from Chazal. And throwing platitudes at him, and throwing quotations at him, and throwing slogans at him, and Eve is an intellect. Eve wants to understand. Eve wants to question. Eve wants to search. It's the same conflict that we've been talking on in all the recent shiurim between the bad people and the big people. Just the difference between a you and an I, that's all it is. But there's a big difference between that you and the I. The little people and the big people. Little people can't think, they can't challenge God. Who am I to challenge God? Ribbono Shel Olam. Who am I? I'm just a bug. Can't challenge the Ribbono Shel Olam. The big person says, but Hashem wants that of me. So again, back to the little boy that's questioning his father. Provided I've said Naaseh, provided I'm not rebelling against Hashem, Hashem wants me to challenge Him. He wants me to expand my mind. He wants me to apply my thinking. He wants me to take the problem and to turn it inside out and to look at it from every facet until I understand exactly where it fits. That's what He wants from me. And Eve is the big person, and the three friends are the little bug people at the time. Very firm, and they know all the quotations, but they're not willing to challenge assumptions. They're not willing to challenge axioms. They're not willing to shake up the foundations of their beliefs and see how it handles it, to see how it withstands that shaking up. They're just not willing to go through that. And it's very, very familiar to today's situation. Very, very familiar. There are very, very few Eves. There are very few people. And Eve goes down. When one thinks of Eve, you think of poor Eve, the man who suffered. So that's not the picture of Eve. The picture of Eve is this great man. This man, this brilliant man, this tzaddik, who in his suffering utilizes his suffering to question the very foundations of existence. That's what the book of Eev is, and that's who Eev was. I'm willing to question the very foundations of existence. I'm prepared to take nothing as a given except one thing, and that is that I'm a tzaddik. It's the only thing I'm prepared to take as a given, because that's the only thing I know for sure. Everything else is open to questioning. Everything else is open to debate and open to discussion. And it's interesting, there's a particular company that's discussing with me the question. They want a revitalization program. They want to come alive again. They think they become stagnant. So I described to them how we would set about it. So the one man person says, one of the top people there says, and they said, this is very nice. The only thing is, where are we going to come out at the end of all this? I said, I don't know. I don't know where you're going to come out at the end of it. You could come out anywhere. And if you insist on knowing where you're going to come out at the end of it, why start in the first place? I said, can you handle that? And he faltered for a moment. He wasn't sure that he could handle that, because all these employees also, the people junior to him, would also be going through this and questioning the fundamentals. And he wasn't quite sure what would come out at the end, whether the whole thing would survive. And the other one present said, if we can't handle that, we have no right to be where we are. That's our job, to handle that. That we've got to be willing to go into a thing like that where we don't know where it's going to come out. Now here, Eve starts a questioning process. Where is it going to come out? And we've got to ask ourselves, isn't he worried where it's going to come out? And we've got to answer to ourselves, where might it come out? What's the worst that could happen? It might come out that he denies God. There is no God. Is it possible that that will happen? My answer is no. Not possible. If bugs start questioning God, that's what will happen. And that's why bugs mustn't question God. Bugs must just do, and they mustn't question God. They must just do, and when there's a discussion, they must only quote. They must never say anything original and intelligent, because who knows what they'll say? They might say all sorts of idiotic things. So they must only quote. They must say, that's how bugs must operate. But if an Eve is questioning, and don't forget the basic premise of Maaseh is there. He's not there to question the halacha, he's keeping the halacha. There isn't the faintest chance that an honest, intelligent Yorei Shemayim will question foundations and not find God. If I believed that was a possibility, then I would be saying that God is a bug. Maybe we won't find him. We'll look around, and you know what? When we look really hard, maybe he won't be there. So let's not look. That's what we mean when we're afraid to question. We don't really believe we'll find God if we start looking too hard, because we think God is small. If we really believe in the Ribbono Shel Olam, if we understand the magnitude of what the Ribbono Shel Olam is and what godliness is and what Torah is, we're not afraid to question. What are we worried about? We won't find him. Is that what we're worried about? No chance of not finding him. The only question is what is going to look like when we find him? That's the only question. What is life going to look like when we find it? What's reality going to look like when we find it? That's the picture we don't know. We don't know what it's going to look like. We don't know what it's going to do to us. We don't know how we're going to get shaken up in the process. But there's no question we'll find the Ribbono Shel Olam, and Eve knows that. And that's why Eve is willing to challenge the Ribbono Shel Olam, because he knows he'll find him. If he's honest, and if he's a Yorei Shemayim, and if he thinks big and properly, if he's intelligent in his analysis, he will find the Ribbono Shel Olam. Those are the three things that need to be in place before an analysis, before an examination can start. There has to be honesty, there has to be Yirah Shemayim, and there has to be intelligence. If an intelligent, honest, God-fearing man searches for God, I do not believe he'll have any difficulty in finding him. And therefore, if I encounter an intelligent, honest, God-fearing man who says, I'm starting to question, I say, go ahead. What an exciting process. Question as much as you like. And he says, what can I question? I say, you can question whatever you want. It can all stand up to you. But if you get the bug starting to question, that's trouble. Then you've got trouble. You can't do that. Because you know what happens? A termite on his own can't do very much damage, but they get together. And when they get together, they dig at the foundations, and they destroy structures, they destroy buildings. That's what happens when bugs start questioning, when bugs start undermining. So we mustn't let the bugs do that. That's certainly not. But big people can do it. And Eve's disappointed in his three friends. He thought they would join him. And so far, Eliphaz hasn't come to the party. The moment Eve starts questioning, Eliphaz gets scared. And that's what Eve accuses him of here. All very nice, you come as a friend. Ki ato heyisem loy. Right now, a few moments ago, you were with him. You were his friend, you were willing to see him through his Torah. And my Torah, says Eov, is not my pain and suffering. My Torah is understanding my pain and suffering, because if I understand it, I can live with it. So I need you to help me understand it. Tiru chasas, the moment you start seeing trembling, we're starting to question the very existence of the Ribono Shel Olam and the foundations of the world. Vatiro, all of a sudden you get scared and you start quoting psukim and you start quoting slogans, and that's the end of any kind of intellectual discussion. Why are you so scared? He says to them now mockingly. Hachiyo marti hovuli? Did I say to you, give me something? I understand that a friend runs away when you ask him for something. All of a sudden, he's happy to be a friend as long as he doesn't have to make a contribution. The moment you say to him, you know, friend, it's all okay, but I expect you to invest something in the friendship too, then very often friends evaporate very quickly. But did I ask you for anything? Did I ask you to sacrifice anything? Did I ask you to use your influence? Sometimes you ask a friend, you say, yeah, you know one of these big shots over there, do you mind giving him a call and asking him for a job for me? All of a sudden your friend disappears, doesn't know you anymore. No, I understand that, you're asking him to use his influence, but I didn't ask you to use your influence. Did I ask you to save me from a tight corner or from the hands of powerful people? If you will show me what I've done to cause you to get so scared, I'll keep quiet. Very interesting discussion he's now having with him. What did I do? Why have I scared you off? You started off as my friend. I told you what I need most urgently from you. Basically, you came and you said, what can I do for you? And I said to you, as my friend, you can join me in my search for meaning. You can join me in my examination. And the moment I start, you become my enemy and telling me that I'm a sinner and that's why God's punishing me. Tell me what I did to make you so scared, and I'll stop. I don't understand what I did that gave you reason to be so insecure. Umashogisi, and if you really believe that I've made a mistake, that I have sinned, hovinuli, make me understand it. Don't tell me it must be so, because God wouldn't punish you if it weren't so. Help me find it. There's no point in being punished for a sin that you don't know. Help me analyze myself. Tell me in what area you think I might have committed these sins. And then I'm willing to question that axiom too. I've started off assuming that I'm a tzaddik. And the reason is because I've questioned that from beginning to end. That's the only thing I am certain of. It's the only knowledge I know for sure. I don't know God and I don't know how God works. That's an area I'm beginning to examine at the moment. But I do know myself. And I do know my life. And I have kept a record of every word I've uttered and of every action that I've done. I told the lady here that I was giving a session to a group of very low level sort of people from an educational point of view, so whites and blacks. And there was a black man sitting, was very quiet, wasn't saying much. I wasn't sure if he understood English at all, never mind what I was saying. And at one point, I don't even remember quite how the conversation came around to it. I think he said he was insulted by his superior, and somebody said to him, didn't you deserve that insult, or didn't you deserve that way of being talked to? And he said, no. And the other person said to him, how do you know? He says, I know, because every night I go home, before I go to bed, I spend a minimum of an hour, and sometimes as much as 2 to 3 hours, going through my day from the time I got up until that time, with a pencil and paper. I go through every word I uttered, I go through every action I did, and I ask myself, in the process, did I hurt anybody? And if there's anybody that I think I might have hurt, by a word that I've said or by an action I did, whether actively or passively, I make a note of it. And the first thing I do the next morning, irrespective of whatever else I've got to do, the very first thing I do the next morning is I go to that person and I apologize. And so I tell him, I was at home last night and I was going over and I realized that I said something that might have offended you. I'm sorry. He said, so don't tell me that I might have deserved what that person did. I know I didn't, because I examine myself all the time. And I said to him, where on earth did you learn that from? I couldn't believe what I was hearing. A black man, an uneducated black man. We don't know what we've got in this country. Well, you won't find that in America. You won't find that in America. No black, no white. No, you won't find that. You'll hardly find that among the Jewish people. Tzaddikim, a few people. I said to him, listen to this one. I said to him, where did you learn that from? Where did you get that? The only other person I've ever heard of doing that in our generation is Rebbe Lopion the Tzaddik. The only person I've heard of it. Might be many others who've done it, but I don't know of it. The only other one I've heard of. And Lahadir, a black man, working in a mine. And he does that every night of his life. I said, firstly, since you were, how old have you been doing this? He said, ever since I can remember, little boy. I said, and who taught you? He said, my father. That's how we live. Do you realize what that is? Eev says, I know myself. If that black man does that, you can be sure Eev did that. Eve says, I know I've done nothing wrong. Now you, Eliphaz, might know something that I don't know. But then tell me. Share it with me. And then I'll be willing to shake that axiom too. But the only piece of knowledge that I feel totally confident in is that I haven't sinned. My nimitsu imre yoshe. How powerful are words that are straight? Well, don't worry about it. If you've got straight things to tell me, don't tell me devious things. But if you've got something straight to tell me, Eve, you did something wrong at such and such a time, this that you did, or this that you thought, or this that you said wasn't right, tell me straight. It's powerful. But one condition. If you're going to prove something to me, prove it from within yourselves. Don't quote slogans to me. Let's have a discussion. And let that discussion come from Miken. Let that discussion come from within you. If you've got something straight to say, tell me. If it's something you believe in as passionately as I believe that I haven't sinned, if you believe that I have, let me hear it. But don't tell me maybe and it must be so, because if it weren't so, God wouldn't be punishing you. Don't talk about that. We're questioning all those things. Don't take those as givens. Our starting point has to be, am I a tzaddik or not? Because if I'm not a tzaddik, that's the end of our discussion. There's nothing to talk about. And I said, I am a tzaddik. And if you're tackling my first axiom, then tackle it. But tackle it mikem, from within you. Halohichach milim tachshoivu uleruach imrei noyash. Because the words that you've thought out, milim tachshevu, the words that you've thought out, halaheichach, they can be used. They can, you can prove with them. I'm willing to listen to anything you've thought out. Ularuach imrei noyash. But if in desperation you're quoting sayings, ularuach, that's meaningless, that's wind, that's hot air. Don't come to me with quotations. Don't come to me with slogans. Don't come to me with things you've heard from other people. If you want to come to me with something you've thought out, let's talk. That I'm willing to challenge you with, and to be challenged by, and to talk and to discuss, absolutely. But not where you're quoting. Afal yosoim tapilu v'sichru al reyachem. Aren't you ashamed of yourselves, he says now, that you've attacked a yosoim, a poor person, a person who's down and out. And you've now attacked him, the sichru al reyachem, and you've sought to undermine your own friend. Instead of helping to build me up, instead of helping me in my examination process, all you're coming is with a hammer and hitting me on the head and telling me I'm a useless nobody and I'm a sinner. Ve'atoren now ho'ilu fenuvi. Apply yourselves to me. Ve'al peneichem im achazev. And I will talk right back at your face and will not lie. I will not be deceitful. I want to be honest in this examination. But you apply yourself to me. Look at me and talk to me. Don't look at your books and quote psukim. Shuvuno al tehi avla. Come back, he said, and let there not be crookedness. The shuvu oed tzidki vo. And in this turning back, Let there be a search of righteousness. Let's be straight and let's be righteous. Hayesh b'lishoni avla im chiki lo yovin havos. Do you think that there is in my tongue any deceit, and that my inside will not be able to understand existence? I'm open, I'm willing to apply myself to understanding, but I need you to be willing to do the same. I can't debate with a tape recorder. I can't debate with somebody that's throwing other ideas, with an artificial intelligence. I can't debate. I can debate with genuine intelligence. I can debate with true feelings. I can debate with straightness. And I will be absolutely open. But that's what I need from you more than anything. To open your souls and be willing to question fundamentals and to look at things from Aleph, from the very first word, and to understand them and to analyze them and to question them. Because only that way are we going to come out with righteousness. Only in that way are we going to come out with a degree of clarity. That's the first half of his reply to Eliphaz. In chapter 7 he continues, he has spent two chapters replying to Eliphaz, and in chapter 7 he attacks the philosophy that Eliphaz used. In chapter 6 he defended himself and he attacked the method that Eliphaz is using. He didn't like the method. The method is not one of intellectual integrity. In chapter 7 he attacks the philosophy, and that even the things you've quoted, even the things you've said, the philosophies you've put forward, that God brings punishment to avoid punishment later on, and all these platitudes that we use to make ourselves feel better when we see hardship that we can't understand, all of that Eev is not prepared to accept, and he challenges in the seventh parak and says, the very philosophy of that I'm not willing to accept. I need to understand something much more fundamental than that, something much more deep than that, and that he does as the Sefer progresses. But the beauty of it at this point is the extent to which we see the process that Eev is demanding, the method that Eev is demanding, the importance of intellectual integrity, the importance of being willing to question no matter what, not to worry what answer you're going to come out with, because there's such integrity in the questioning process, and there's such an acceptance and an assumption of the existence of the Ribbono Shel Olam to start with, and there's such an acceptance of halacha. There's no attempt to use this as an easy out. On the contrary, all this is an inquiry after the truth, a desire to understand what it's really all about. That's the only thing that it is, and if that's all it is, he will find the truth. If that's all it is, he will find the Ribbono Shel Olam. And the only casualties in the process, unless the three friends adapt themselves to Eev's standards and to Eev's process and method, the casualties won't be Eev, and the casualty won't be God. God will survive this in analysis. He'll be able to sit through it and he'll come out okay. And Eev will survive it. He'll be able to sit through it and come through it okay. The question is, will the three friends be able to survive it? That's the question. Will the bugs be able to survive it? Are they going to be able to themselves grow in stature as the process develops and become powerful and part of this process, or are they going to have to stand on the sidelines and just be unable to relate to what's really happening? That's really the question that is going to fascinate us as we watch this process unfolding, and as we watch Eev growing in the process, and as we watch the Ribbono Shel Olam ultimately growing in the process. What's going to happen to the three friends?